You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 26, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, guys, how was the March for Science?
Insane. Who all went?
Marching.
Bob and I went to Boston. It was good. It was the green in Boston was fairly packed. It was a good crowd. A lot of good signs, you know. And I think it was good. I mean, there's a lot of talk about, you know, what's going to happen. How's it going to go? Is it going to be too political? It was fine. It was just a bunch of nerds with signs.
Of course.
And, you know, promoting signs. I thought it was fine.
So I was lucky enough to be a co-host for the DC event, the kind of the big one. And it was awesome. I co-hosted with my friend Derek Muller, who is Veritasium on YouTube, and Questlove Gomez from The Roots, who you may know if you listen to The Roots or if you watch The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, because they're their house band. Music was John Batiste and Stay Human. They were kind of the house band for the event. It was, first of all, pouring down rain the entire time. Like
that
pouring.
That sucks.
Yeah, like the stage was flooded. Yeah. His piano was wet. The prompters went out because they were soaking wet. People's papers were falling apart in front of them. And regardless of that, the turnout was insane. I know that they had a permit for 75,000 people on the part of the mall between the Washington Monument and the White House. And it was so full that there were people waiting for like multiple blocks away. They had to wait for people to leave for more people to be able to come in. And that was just for the rally before the march. So I don't want to get, you know, I don't want to guesstimate my own numbers, but I wouldn't be surprised if twice that came out for the march because it was packed, packed, packed. So it was so much fun.
In the pouring rain. That's
in
incredible.
The pouring rain. I got to interview some incredible kids out on the mall and ask them why they were there marching for the show. I got to rile up the crowd.
Kids like science?
Yeah. Awesome. And there were kids with great handmade signs. There was a girl, I interviewed a girl who was like, I don't know, 7, 8 years old, and she had built her own battle bot and she was showing it off to everybody. She was super cool.
Nice.
And a lot of great speakers. Obviously, Michael Mann was there. Some of the founders of the Earth Day Network, Bill Nye was there, and it was kind of like a very heavy environmentally focused march in DC, simply because it was in partnership with the Earth Day Network because they were
it's Earth Day,
and Earth Day Network does a big thing every year there in DC, so it was like a perfect mix. I met the girl Little Miss Flint, the whistleblower from Flint, Michigan. She was adorable. I have no idea how old she was, maybe 6. And she got up on stage and they were like, okay, take it away. And she wouldn't talk. She froze up. She looked like she started to cry. And then her mom goes, Lego set. And she just burst into action.
What? that's her trigger word.
That's my trigger word too.
Lego set girl. Come on, give your speech. We're going to go shopping. So that was really funny. But yeah, it was a ton of fun. And then I got to march with everybody. And it was a blast.
Bob and I came across one person who had a poster with, what were there, about like 10 pictures of women in science? And then you were tasked to identify
14
them.
To 16, yeah.
Or 16.
Oh, yeah, right.
So Bob and I think we did respectably, but you know, I knew a lot of them, but like not, I didn't recognize their picture. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah. You know them by name.
I know them more by name. Sight. Yeah, but there, you know, there were some obvious ones that we got, but that was hard. That was fun.
Yeah, that's an old-timey picture. It must be Curie. And I was right. Yeah,
Curie was easy to recognize.
Did you guys dress up at all? Did you wear like t-shirts or did you carry signs?
We had our shirts on, absolutely.
Oh, your SGU t-shirts. Great. That's awesome.
We did not self-promote. We did Nerdy Science t-shirts.
Oh, good.
So I had my shirt was, you know, Rosie the Riveter. Well, Rosie was a robot, and it was awesome in that same pose.
Oh, cool!
The biceps.
With the bicep flex.
I love
and
it.
What
about yours, Steve? Rag.
Mine said, "Resistance is not futile; it's voltage divided by current."
That's awesome.
Not as cool as a robot, but still awesome.
And I wanted to wear a Nerdy t-shirt, but I wasn't allowed to because the stream was going out, you know, on TV, and there's all these rules about like wearing shirts with print and font and getting release forms. But there's an incredible chick named Holly Renee, and she does a clothing line called Shinova, and she made me a dress for the event, and it was like this beautiful pink gown with the Fibonacci sequence on it.
Oh, awesome.
It was so cool. Yeah, and I got so many compliments on it. I felt awesome up there on stage, repping for math. It was so much fun.
What were the best signs you guys saw?
Like a lot using the square root of -1 instead of imaginary. Yep. Like that's a common pun that people use. Yep.
I like the one, no science means no beer. That was popular.
Yeah, and like, what do we want? Science, when do we want it? After peer review. That's a common one.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Citation, a lot of citation needed.
Yeah.
There is no plan. Yeah, plan like with a little ETB. Yeah, that was a popular one as well. All right, well, let's move on with our own forgotten superhero of science, Bob. Who do you got for this week?
Yes, for this week's superheroes of science, I'm discussing Peggy Whitson, born in 1960. She is a biochemical scientist and astronaut who has attained a plethora of impressive firsts. Whitson was born and raised on a farm in Iowa. So did James Kirk. Very
I thought of that as well. Definitely. Iowa.
Soon after getting her doctorate in biochemistry, she started working at Johnson Space Center, which eventually led to actually becoming an astronaut. After kind of a circuitous path of different jobs, she became an astronaut. And on April 24th, 2 days before this podcast is being recorded, Whitson broke the record for most cumulative time in space by an American. An amazing feat. She beat cosmonaut? What? All right, I didn't understand this when I read it. She beat cosmonaut Jeff Williams' record of 534 days, 2 hours, 48 minutes, 17.328 seconds, which, of course, I made that last bit up.
I was going to say, that seems very specific.
They're far too accurate. But I don't know why. Are they referring to all of them as cosmonauts now? Because if she broke the American record, who cares if she beat a cosmonaut's record? But Jeff Williams doesn't sound very cosmonauty. So, okay, whatever. It is what it is. She has the record. So let's see. Let's go through some of these first. She was the first woman to command the International Space Station during her expedition in expedition number 16 in 2007. This year, she became the first woman to command it twice, meaning that right now and until August 2017, she's up there and she is in command of the International Space Station.
Can you imagine?
Yeah,
can you imagine?
So cool.
What do you put it? Imagine putting that on your resume. Yeah, I was commander of a space station in orbit around the Earth. I mean, what else do you need?
That's a lot more fun than being a commander of a space station that's not in orbit.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. I used to be. Yeah. When I was 8 years old, I'd play in a cardboard box. Yeah. I was the commander of the space station.
So if that's not, is that not good enough? Then she is also the oldest woman to do a spacewalk and has the woman's record for most spacewalks, something like 52 hours. And then to top all that off, she was named the chief of the astronaut office in 2009, the first woman to hold that position, which she held until 2012. So fantastic. And then the latest news, hot off the presses, Peggy Whitson will be involved in the very first 4K live video broadcast from the space station with Sam Blackman, who is the CEO and co-founder of AWS Elemental. So that's another first for Peggy that happened today.
It happened today.
Today.
Yep.
Oh, cool.
So remember Peggy Whitson after this latest news cycle, of course. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing gravity gradient effects, osteopenia, or even the Vesda space toilet.
Yeah.
Osteopenia, huh?
Now, does the Coriolis effect have an effect on that space toilet?
Oh, space toilets? Fun. If you guys have not read Packing for Mars by Mary Roach, I highly recommend it. You will learn everything you need to know about how to poop in space. You do it over a video camera in order to practice.
What? Oh.
Yeah.
What?
You have to learn to aim perfectly.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there's a video camera with a monitor that you practice on.
Wait a minute. Aim? Like aiming? There's no aiming and pooping.
Yeah.
Like in these cars where they have these cameras that come on when you reverse the
basically,
car?
Basically, yeah. It's a toilet's eye view.
No way.
Wow, that sounds pretty shitty.
That sounds pretty shitty. Did you just say that, Bob?
Somebody had to say. Come on. Get over with.
Also, you know, it helps you evade those alligators in the toilet, you know, from the sewer system in case they crawl up.
I can imagine that is an extremely rarefied skill.
Yes.
Accuracy in pooping. Not many people have to master that skill. Okay. But you know what? In 100 years, it'll be an Olympic sport. Right?
Oh, wow.
The Space Olympics.
Space poop.
Yeah, space pooping. All right, Kara, tell us about worms that eat plastic.
Yeah, guys, this is a cool story. Just kind of hit the presses a couple of days ago. Wax worms, which are technically caterpillars, I guess, if you want to be entomological about it. Wax worms are so named because they hang out in beehives. They're actually beehive pests in Europe. But here in the United States, they're commonly sold as bait or as like worms to feed your pet lizard. So there's a researcher, I love this story, named Federica Bertuccini, and she is a Spanish researcher, and she is also an avid beekeeper. So she goes out to her beehive and is cleaning it up and realizes that she has some of these wax worm pests. She picks them up out of the beehive and puts them in a plastic bag, you know, a crappy little single-use plastic bag like we all see. And then she goes to clean the hives and then comes back and realizes that the little worms have eaten their way out of the plastic bag. And she thinks to herself, and mind you, she is not an entomologist. She is not a material scientist. She actually is a developmental embryologist. But she has decided that this is an interesting phenomenon. I wonder if these worms are actually metabolizing this plastic. Are their mouth parts just chewing through it, or are they actually physically eating it? Because if they're physically eating it, we could be onto something here. So, like a good scientist, even though it's completely out of her field, she decided to study it, which I think is so cool. And she did that. And she, you know, obviously joined up with some scientists who have more knowledge in that field. And they published a paper. It's actually called Polyethylene Biodegradation by Caterpillars of the Wax Moth Galleria Melonella. And that was published in Current Biology just a couple of days ago. And they looked at the rate at which these little guys chomped through plastic. And one way that they decided to figure out, are they actually just physically chomping through plastic, or are they, you know, eating the plastic and metabolizing it, is that they took a bunch of these guys and they ground them up and they kind of made a paste out of them and they put it on top of the plastic and walked away. And they found that even that ate through the plastic, and they were able to test for the constituent parts. And they found that to some extent, the polyethylene was being converted into ethylene glycol, as we know is the main constituent in antifreeze. And that's a byproduct of breaking down the polymers in the polyethylene. So it showed that at least to a certain level, it's physically degrading the plastic by breaking some of its polymer bonds. And of course, it sort of makes sense if you think about it. These little caterpillars evolved an ability to metabolize wax in these different beehives. And wax is sort of a natural polymer. Obviously, it's not a plastic, but it has some similar structural composition to plastic. And so it seems like potentially utilizing their ability to break down the wax in order to break down polyethylene or even potentially polypropylene, these could have an interesting use in conservation biology in order to get rid of some of this plastic. Like, do you guys say detritus or detritus?
I say detritus.
I say garbage.
Ha, it's 50-50. Okay, yeah. This plastic garbage. I'm always fascinated by how people pronounce things. And so obviously in all of the reporting, there's been some great reporting on this. A good reporter is going to talk to somebody who was not involved in the study and say, like, are these researchers overly zealous? And of course, there's always somebody who works in this field who says, of course, like, it doesn't seem reasonable to just put millions of these worms, because the rate is not that fast. It's way faster than any historical rates of bacteria or fungus eating through plastic, because, you know, we've found a few candidate species that do that. It's way faster, but it's still, like, not reasonable to just dump a bunch of worms into a landfill and let them go at it. First of all, landfills are anaerobic mostly. Like, most of these things would suffocate because there's just not enough oxygen available once they get down deep into it. And second of all, why would they choose to eat plastic if they have, like, food available to them? But of course, then the author, Dr. Bertuccini, said, no, that's not the point. The point is, this is a first stage study that shows that there's actually some metabolism going on. Once we can figure out what's responsible for that, whether it's an enzyme in the mouth parts of these worms, whether it's an enzyme in the stomach, whether it's bacteria that are housed within these worms, if we can isolate whatever that enzyme is and then synthesize it, maybe we can actually use that to break down plastic, and that could have really great environmental effects. So super interesting story. I'm excited to see where it goes.
Because plastic's a huge problem.
I just see those islands of plastic out in the ocean, and that really makes me so sad.
Makes you sick. So yeah, in 2014, 311 million tons of plastic were produced. I think that's like the best number. And that figure is set to double, according to Ed Yong, who wrote about this in The Atlantic, double in the next 20 years. And about 40% of that consists of polyethylene, which is the plastic polymer that these little guys seem to be able to at least partially metabolize. That's things like single-use plastic bags, which it's insane to me that they still exist. They're banned where I live in LA and in a lot of parts of California. But also things, I think, like styrofoam takeout containers. All these things that you only use once and then you get rid of. And so, of course, the environmental angle here and the angle from a lot of these conservation biologists that are environmental biologists that were spoken to for these articles is we can't just worry about cleaning it up later with worms or even with an enzyme. We need to be trying not to make so much now not to use single-use plastics. And of course, it needs to be a multi-pronged approach. But the fact of the matter is, even if we stopped producing plastic now, there's still so much that it doesn't biodegrade. We know this. It just breaks down and breaks down to be smaller and smaller and smaller until eventually it looks like plankton. And that, as you mentioned, Evan, the plastic gyres in the middle of the ocean, the big issue is that you don't physically see plastic. You see fishing line and sometimes bottle caps and things like that. But really in those big gyres like the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, the plastic has been beaten down and broken up that it's so small, it looks like plankton. And so it's just packing the guts of all of these marine animals, and it's absolutely detrimental to them. It's really, really sad.
Contributing to the death of the ocean, no doubt.
Totally, yeah. And, you know, Kara, like this has actually the item I'm going to talk about tonight. There is this idea about just having scientists experiment on stuff. You know, money needs to be spent on things that might seem weird or crazy or silly. You know, who would think that a caterpillar can eat plastic and have an impact?
And also, I don't know, there's something about this story that I love so much, that human element of just this researcher, it's not even her field, kind of sees something curious and goes, huh, maybe I should look into that. And what if she never had? What if she hadn't kept her eyes open? Mm-hmm. You know, I love that. That's the scientific spirit that you don't even have to be a researcher to have.
So that reminds me of a quote. This is attributed to Isaac Asimov. I'm not sure if that's been 100% confirmed, but I think we've used it on the show before. The most exciting phrase to hear in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, is not eureka, but rather, huh, that's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it.
I love that one.
Touched on that.
That's so good.
All right, Jay, tell us about artificial photosynthesis.
Yeah, so a chemistry professor in Florida named Fernando Uribe Romo and his team of students recently published their research in the Journal of Materials Chemistry A, and they claim to have developed a way to trigger the process of photosynthesis, but it's in a synthetic material. There are two kinds of photosynthesis. I'm going to be talking about oxygenic photosynthesis, and keep in mind, I'm just going to give this quick explanation. So during oxygenic photosynthesis, sunlight hits the chloroplast in the plant, which causes an enzyme to break apart a water molecule into oxygen, hydrogen, and electrons. And the oxygen diffuses out of the plant. They call it the waste product, which I think is kind of funny when you think about oxygen as a waste or a byproduct. Yep. And then other chemical reactions occur where CO2 is used to form glucose. So it pulls CO2 out of the atmosphere, combines it with some of the other things that are there, like I said, hydrogen and the other electrons, and it makes glucose, and that's plant food, essentially. Now, back to the research, the team developed a synthetic metal organic framework of molecules that's shaped in such a way that it absorbs a certain frequency of light, using that as the energy source, and then it breaks down carbon dioxide into harmless organic material. Now, the scientist, Fernando, he showed a 3D printed molecule, you know, an object about the size of a Rubik's cube, of what the molecule looks like. And it's really cool looking. So it looks like kind of like a Rubik's cube that you flattened a little bit. And then there's these like triangular pieces that were taken out in an organized way out of it. So there's lots of holes inside this, you know, the shell of a cube. The molecules get stuck in there, and it also can absorb the blue frequency of light, and it uses that as the energy source. And there's a few corners about this technology that are really fascinating. So the real achievement here is that they're using blue light, which is much more common in sunlight than UV light, which is traditionally what frequency of light that they would use as an energy source to do this. Nobody could achieve, or they were having a hard time achieving it with other wavelengths of light. And he figured out a way to use blue light as a source of energy, which is great because there's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of that in the normal light that hits the Earth.
So yeah, so like as Jay said, this MOF, metal organic framework, is the absolute key to this entire thing. They've used MOFs in the past to cause these chemical reactions, and they're quite fascinating, but they haven't been able to do it in the past using metals that were cheap or metals that could actually use the colored visible light of the sun. They could make it with ultraviolet light. That's been done, but ultraviolet's only about 4% of the output of the sun, so it wasn't very efficient. So they've been trying to do what Fernando pretty much did, and they couldn't do it for decades. So what he did though was he started with titanium, and so that was the metal core that is in the middle of all these MOFs. And then he picked specific organic molecules that I can't pronounce that were designed to absorb the blue light. So in the experiment, they put MOFs that absorbed specific amounts of carbon dioxide into an LED photoreactor, and then turned the blue lights on. That the blue light mimics the sun's blue light. And when it was done, it basically worked. The chemical reaction changed the CO2 that had diffused into these MOFs, and then the light that hit the molecule was kind of transferred to the gas that was in these little storage containers of the MOF, and then reduced them using that blue light from the sun to carbon, or reduced forms of carbon, namely formate and formamides. Is that how you pronounce that? And so they're calling these materials a type of solar fuel. So Fernando said, it's like photosynthesis, in which a plant picks up sunlight and carbon dioxide and turns it into sugar. So in this case, instead of having a plant, we have a material like this, referring to the MOFs, that captures the sunlight and turns the CO2 into something similar to sugar.
But one of the reasons why I like this news item, because, you know, there's a lot of them that come up like this, right? You know, it doesn't scale up or whatever. The blue light ends up, you know, creating monsters, whatever. The point here is I like it because it reminded me of how much we need to have people just doing weird experimentation and trying things and keep iterating things and failing and failing and failing. When science is so riddled with failure, but it's part of the process. You know, and if we get too tight with budgets, like, you know, you think everybody knows where I'm going with this, with all the science funds being cut so severely. I mean, this is an epidemic that's going on.
Yeah, well, what I like about it is that something I think we've talked about before. What is the solution to our global warming problem? It's going to take a lot of different things, but emerging technology, new technology has to be part of that equation. Yeah. And this is one example.
But the problem is I don't know. I still think that these artificial leaves or synthetic photosynthesis are years away. And this isn't the first group to claim to have artificial photosynthesis. I've read several reports.
Sure.
Like Daniel Nocera's group at Harvard just last year published a paper again saying new breakthrough, like the most efficiency, whatever, new system. What they do is they have a catalyst that splits water into hydrogen and oxygen, and then they have bacteria that eats the CO2 and uses the hydrogen to make biofuel, basically, but is using it from CO2 out of the air. And
oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So anytime you're using a catalyst to split water using the energy from sunlight, they're calling it artificial photosynthesis, which is reasonable. But we are still in the infancy of these technologies. I think we are a decade.
Yeah, of course. But so what? What's
or
your
two
point, Steve?
Away.
We have to start now. You know what I mean?
No, I'm just putting it into perspective. But I do think if you start throwing things around like this is going to help with global warming, I mean, I have no doubt that, you know, in the next 50 to 100 years, we're going to have all sorts of awesome technologies for energy and scrubbing and whatever. The question is it going to be in time? And I don't know that these technologies are going to be developed quickly enough that they're going to contribute significantly to avoiding the negative outcomes of global warming. They might help reverse them eventually, but...
Well, sure. None of these things stand on their own as any one solution. Yeah. There's no panacea here. There's nobody should have a, sort of this false hope.
Yeah, yeah. We still have to stop pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Exactly. Is the bottom line. Well, guys, are you ready for a non-controversial question?
No.
Absolutely, Steve. Hit me.
Here it is. This is sure to be completely uninteresting, and nobody, I think, will have any controversy over this at all. The question is... Did Jesus actually exist?
Whoa!
We got to ask Joseph and Mary.
Oh, God.
I put my dice down right now on no.
My initial reaction is, yeah, I suppose he did. Doesn't make him a savior or son of God or anything, but a person named Jesus probably existed.
What about the ex-Mormon? What do you think, Karen?
I don't know if there was like a dude that like is described. Obviously, we know he didn't do all the things that they say that he did, but like maybe there was a dude who like was exceptionally clean and people were like, wow, that's really impressive. Or maybe Jesus is an amalgamation of a bunch of people. I personally don't know if there was like a single dude.
So it's a yes, no, and a maybe. Sounds like I'm getting. Okay.
It's spread. Sounds like science or fiction.
So I'm interested in this question, not because I, you know, again, none of us are believers. I'm not interested. You know, sometimes I think atheists try to build a case that there was no historical Jesus because it's a knockout punch for Christianity, right? If it didn't actually exist. But again, I'm not interested in that either. This is not about whether or not you believe or to attack Christianity. But if you just divorce this from the religious implications and just ask, just as a historical question, do we actually know if Jesus existed as a historical figure or not? And I wrote about this recently, and the discussion afterward was fascinating because you really delve into a lot of the questions that we deal with as skeptics in terms of like, how do we know anything and what should our opinion be towards consensus and the motivated reasoning all over the place. It's just fascinating. Mm. Let me tell you what I think is uncontroversial and what we do know. So it's definitely true that the majority of biblical and ancient history scholars who are experts in this area, the consensus opinion is that there was a historical Jesus of Nazareth.
A single dude.
A person called. Then you say, okay, what do we know about this historical Jesus? And the consensus, I think, is also that we know very little. And the features that I think that the consensus would agree upon was that he was a Jewish preacher, in Judea around that time, that he apparently was baptized and that he was crucified. That's about it. And maybe that, you know, he was called the Messiah and, you know, therefore he's linked to the later Christian cult. So that's about it. All other details. There's no consensus about whether they were accurate or not. However, there is also a minority opinion. Some would call it a fringe opinion. And whether or not you use minority or fringe definitely depends on where you are in terms of your own belief. But unfortunately, by some scholars, but by a lot of non-scholars, called the mythicist position, which is that Jesus did not actually exist, Jesus is entirely a myth that then only later was claimed to have actually existed. And there are a number of different hypotheses within that camp. The notion that he was an amalgamation of many individuals, that the early Christians didn't claim that he was a real physical person, that he was only ever a spiritual being and then later was turned into a historical being. If I had to summarize the mythicist position, I would say they don't really make a good case for any of their alternative hypotheses, you know, from a purely historical point of view. And I've read a ton of what they have to say. And while I think a lot of them correctly point out the weaknesses in the line of evidence for a historical Jesus. I don't really think they do a good job of proposing an alternate hypothesis. So let's talk about what is the evidence that that scholars point to that they find convincing. And this is where I get very interested. It's like, all right, do I find this evidence convincing? And is their logic really valid? So another thing that we could say is there's no smoking gun evidence that Jesus existed as a real person, right? So there's no – Jesus didn't write anything, right? There's no book according to Jesus. He didn't leave any writings behind. And there is no firsthand eyewitness account. His disciples didn't write anything. And there is no contemporary, meaning at the time that he was alive, historical accounts of him.
Yeah, it's all at least 100 years after his death.
Right. Well, depends on what you mean by it. But so the first, the first mention of Jesus in anything were the letters of Paul. So these are pre-Gospels. These are starting in around 20 to 30 years after Jesus allegedly died. So around 50 to 60 CE, right? Or AD, depending on your inclination. So, and Paul never met Jesus. He claimed that he had visions from Jesus. So he only knows of Jesus through his own visions. And he was clearly writing mainly to sort of create the rules of the early church, the kind is what he was involved with, like, you know, talking about, you know, how things were going to work.
It's interesting.
And some of like the canon about what Jesus taught. And there's a lot of discussion about, was he really just imposing his own philosophy on early Christianity, you know?
Yeah.
And ascribing it to somebody named Jesus.
Yes, but some of the mythicists make so many terrible arguments that it really, I think, taints the whole, you know, all skepticism about the historicity of Jesus. Because when you read like actual biblical scholars, like, oh my God, these guys are so full of it. They can make all these terrible arguments that are not based on what we're actually saying, all these straw men. So like some of them try to say that if you read the letters of Paul, the ones that are, so there's only like, I think seven of them are real and the other six are forgeries or clearly later forgeries. But the ones that were probably written by Paul, who there is a consensus was a historical person, that he clearly is saying that he thought that Jesus was a real person that lived, that was, you know, that lived and died.
Paul convinced himself that Jesus was real.
What we actually know is not really very debatable and not controversial. It's all how you interpret it. And how you interpret it comes down to what you think is convincing. And it's completely subjective. And so people are arguing about how to infer whether Jesus existed or not. It's all about inference and what's the best inference and what's a reasonable inference. And so you can't factor judgment out of that. And so people are just making different judgments about how to infer whether Jesus was a historical figure or not. But some of the mythicists go beyond that and just make really silly non-factual claims. So that's why I'm saying they kind of muddy what would be an otherwise interesting historical conversation by saying things like, oh, Paul thought that he was a spiritual being only. Well, no, if you clearly didn't, he clearly thought that he was a living person. Whether or not he was is a separate question, but he thought that he was. He writes as if he thought that he was. I mean, that's because that's clear in the writing. And if you try to say anything else, you're really doing mental gymnastics. Okay, so that's fine. So we know. So we have the visions of Paul, right? And again, although he claims he met James, the brother of Jesus, and that he claims he met the disciples, but we're still now, you know, like two steps removed at best. So that's the earliest writings. The Gospels are a mess. And this is where I think that the people arguing that the Gospels favor the inference that Jesus was a real person have a really weak argument. Very, very weak. They're clearly just a codification of different and conflicting oral traditions. You know, you have the three synoptic gospels, Mark, Matthew, and Luke, and then you have John, which is completely different than the other three. Like, there's far more that's different than there is overlap. And even in the areas where they overlap, the details are all different. These are clearly two separate oral traditions that got written down 60 years later by different people. We don't even know who they are, for different audiences, for different purposes. And so that's where the mythology comes in, right? That's where you say, okay, the Gospels are really the Jesus mythology. And so the second question is, well, what is the relationship, if Jesus did exist as a real person, what's the relationship between that actual person and the later Christian mythology of the life of Jesus? And I think that, you know, there's a good scholarly consensus for that there's a very weak relationship between those two things. But let me get to the other bit about, so these are the big things that scholars point to say that why they would infer that the simplest, the most parsimonious explanation of the facts is that Jesus was a real person. And one is the argument from embarrassment, which is an interesting argument. And I'm not sure I completely buy it, because I think largely an argument from ignorance. I think a lot of the inferences that the scholars are making are ultimately come down to arguments from ignorance. So, for example, right, they say, so there are some details. There are some details about the canon of the life of Jesus that they cannot make sense of as just Jewish tradition or evolving out of some mythological tradition. So one is that Jesus was from Nazareth, right? It's Jesus of Nazareth. And that this, I found this to be a very interesting argument, not a home run, but I think very interesting. They say, listen, the Old Testament says that the Messiah is going to come from Bethlehem. So if you were going to make up a Messiah, you would just have him be from Bethlehem. But for no reason that any scholar can figure out, there's the introduction of this totally arbitrary detail that Jesus's family, that his mother, was from this completely otherwise religiously irrelevant, unremarkable, tiny little town of Nazareth. Why would they ever include that detail? And then they had to manufacture this story to explain why he was actually born in Bethlehem, about
with the stable.
Oh, yeah, with the whole the census and the thing with the stable. Yeah, so they said that they clearly made that up. That's ahistorical. Why did they make that up? Why did they make up this story about, because he was from Nazareth? If they were making up the thing out of whole cloth, why didn't they just say he was from Bethlehem? Their inference is the only reason why that detail is in the story is because it relates to an actual person from Nazareth. And I think that's a reasonable argument. I find that argument to be completely reasonable, but I do think it's not as compelling as they think it is, because ultimately it's an argument from ignorance. It's because they don't know why that detail would be in there. Therefore, it has to be the only one thing that they could think about. But I think they are underestimating the, you know, in a way, how legends can evolve. So I think there's a lot more chaos. Yeah, there's a lot more chaos to how stories evolve. So if at some point that element got into the mythology, it would perseverate, you know, it would continue, and people would want to accommodate it to keep it connected to this evolving mythology that was going on. So I don't think they really give proper consideration to the other ways in which these errant details would get in there. All right, here's another. So in fact, they say the only things we know about Jesus for sure are the things that would have been embarrassing to the authors. So one is he's from Nazareth. Makes no sense unless you think he's a real person. The other one was his baptism, because if Jesus was the Son of God, he doesn't have to be baptized. And so why do they have that detail in there? Again, they have to introduce these sort of fixes to make it work religiously or theologically. Like in Matthew, Jesus says to John, all right, I'll go through this just to be on the up and up, right? But he kind of makes a comment that says, you don't really have to baptize me, but we'll do it. You know, just to be clear.
Just to check the box.
Yeah, just to check.
I didn't know that baptism was like, I don't know why. I didn't realize baptism predated the idea of Jesus. Oh, I mean, obviously it did, because John the Baptist baptized him according to the lore. But I guess I always assumed that was like not a retrofit, but that was just kind of like the start of the kind of trend of baptism.
No. It pre-existed. Gotcha. So, and then John just has John the Baptist, in the Gospel according to John, he doesn't baptize Jesus at all.
Yeah,
he just eliminates it. Just, oh, okay, I'm just going to, he doesn't baptize Jesus. So they sort of, they conflict with each other, but they fix the problem in different ways. But again, the scholars would argue, well, why is it even a problem? Why do they even have that element in this story when it's just an embarrassment they have to figure out, work around, you know? And then the third thing is the crucifixion, because they say that being nailed to a tree was like a huge insult in the Jewish culture at that time, and so like crucifixion was especially offensive to the Jewish people, and the idea that your Messiah was crucified was like a joke. It was ridiculous. And again, and in fact, I didn't know this until I was reading a lot of material about this, that the early Christian church did not use the crucifix as a symbol until after crucifixion was banned as a method of execution. And again, their inference from that is that that's because, again, they were embarrassed by the fact that Jesus was crucified. And so they didn't want any reminders of that. Therefore, again, why would that detail be in the story unless he actually was crucified? So that's why those are the elements they think are real. He was from Nazareth, he was baptized, and he was crucified. And the reason why they think those elements are real is because they can't come up with another explanation as to why those embarrassing and problematic, theologically problematic elements are in the story unless they have to be there because they're attached to an actual historical person. What do you guys think about that? That's their argument. That's their big line of evidence, you know, that he was historical, was those inconvenient facts that they had to work around in the story. But I'm not sure.
Whoa. That's flimsy.
How compelling I find that argument. Yeah, I mean,
it's not real evidence, is it?
Yeah, well, it's good.
Yeah, I mean, none of it's evidence.
None of it's direct evidence. It's just an indirect inference. But then they invoke Occam's razor. It's the simplest way to explain those facts. You will invoke Occam's razor, which is fine.
Okay. That only gets you so far.
But it only gets you so far. Yeah, exactly. It's like, that there was, who the hell knows what the hell was going on? You know, there was 20 years before anybody mentioned anything. And it was really 60 years before the Gospels really got written down. And there were other Gospels that got purged, this is the canon that was decided on 300 years later. There was all kinds of Christian beliefs and sects, and it was chaos for a few hundred years until basically it became the official religion of Rome. And they said, and here's the canon. These four gospels are real. Everything else is heresy. And so the other gospels got sidelined,
Yeah, but for me, Steve, the deal breaker is a century of the telephone game.
Yeah,
that's it. Right. Bible after that.
What? Oh my God! Right.
I agree. Without botching that up.
Yeah, I agree.
Also, I wonder if this is the first incident of in the historical record of fake news in a way.
probably not the first, but so I agree. That's the problem I have with it. It's like this 20, 30, 60 years of oral tradition. Whoa. Mm-mm. And then they're trying to argue that oral tradition could be reliable. Sorry.
No, I think that's not right.
So the thing is, oral tradition can be reliable once elements have settled into a culture. You know what I mean? Once an idea is embedded in a culture, sure, it could hang around for a long time, but not the details. And also, during times of transition, all bets are off. Sure, once this became codified, then that became everything else was heresy. I could see that persisting for a long time.
But even then, there's no guarantee that it's accurate.
Yeah,
there's only a guarantee that it's consistent.
But they admit that the early church was chaos. They admit there was tons of conflicting oral traditions. Even the scholars who think, the simplest explanation is that some guy named Jesus exists and was executed, that all the other elements are just mythology. So, one way I'd like to look at it, even if you think there was a person named Jesus and that there is some relationship between them and Christianity, that the story of Jesus, though, that's in the New Testament, that's in the Gospels, that's mythology. And there is so much cultural precedent for the major, you know, the broad brushstrokes. But this is another thing where you get into this inference game where whatever you're motivated to believe, you could make an argument for it, right? So, like, for example, the notion of a miraculous birth, of being part divine, part human, the notion of being making a sacrifice and being a savior, of ascending, of even of performing miracles while you were going around proselytizing. Those are all common elements that were assigned to many people at the time.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So, but here's another layer where motivated reasoning comes in. So obviously when you make analogies between two different figures or two different stories, they're never identical. So do you focus on the similarities or the differences? If you want to say that there was precedence that predates Jesus, you could focus on the similarities. If you want to say that Jesus was unique, you could focus on the differences. You can build a case either way, depending on what you want to focus on. And even with the Gospels, like, you know, I had people commenting, you know, on my blog about all the similarities about in the Gospels, or you could comment on all the differences and the conflicts in them. You know, you could kind of see it either way, depending on what kind of case you're trying to build. It's very interesting. Here is another sort of line of evidence that I found to be problematic. It's not really evidence, it's a line of argument where, so a lot of the mythicists point to the fact that there is such little so they make the argument from silence, right? So people were not talking about Jesus. Nobody was talking about Jesus except the Christians a generation later, right? Why is that? If he was a guy walking around, you know, casting out demons and raising the dead, nobody seemed to be interested in that and nobody was talking about it. And then the scholars say that's a naive argument, you know, that essentially that our historical record is so sparse that you wouldn't really expect anybody to be talking about one obscure apocalyptic preacher from Judea, you know, 2,000 years ago. So the absence of other mentions is not remarkable. They're both wrong in a way. It's like, yes, there is the absence of direct evidence, which means that there's the absence of evidence, but I agree that's not very compelling evidence for absence in this case because the record is sparse. And they make all kinds of comparisons, like, did you know that we only know about Alexander the Great from people writing about him hundreds of years later? So if you believe Alexander the Great was a real person, why wouldn't you believe that, you know, Jesus of Nazareth was a real person? Right. And so I don't like that analogy. Right, yeah, I don't like that analogy because as soon as you introduce religion, all bets are off. Right. So what they're ignoring is there really isn't any compelling ideological reason for somebody to make up Alexander the Great. But if you're starting a religion, you have a motivation to you know, manufacture or progress, evolve a story about your central figure, you know, of your faith. So I don't think the two contexts are in any way comparable, I do agree that, yeah, there's very little evidence of anybody in the ancient world. And that in and of itself is not an argument against, you know, Jesus of Nazareth being a real person. But it means we don't have that, but still it doesn't wipe away the fact that we don't have evidence, direct evidence for him. It's all inferential. And I think a little logically tenuous, although, so what I would summarize it as saying we certainly can't prove he didn't exist. I mm-hmm. haven't read any compelling mm-hmm. theories that provide a viable alternative hypothesis that I would support in the mythicist category. But I think that we just don't know is where I would come down, that the evidence is inferential, it's thin. It's reasonable to interpret it as, yeah, you could explain those things as they're coming from a real person. That's fine. That's compatible. You know, real historical figures get mythologized all the time, and that's a known process. And it's perfectly reasonable to say that the eventual Christian mythology was the result of mythologizing this one guy who would have just been another really tiny cult if Rome didn't make it its official religion 300 years later. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think we can rule out the other possibilities. And like, for example, and this may be coming from the difference between the perspective of a historian and the perspective of a skeptic. And I do wonder how much the biblical historians have informed their opinion by studying modern mythologies. Think about the Roswell incident. Mm-hmm. Think about what the cult of believers think happened. They think a flying saucer landed, the government recovered it, they covered it up, they did an autopsy on recovered alien bodies, there are eyewitnesses, there are alleged, you know, physical evidence. There's all, and it's all bullshit. It's all out of nothing. I shouldn't say nothing. So when I use that as an example, people are like, yeah, but something did crash there and those people actually existed. Yeah, I said, yeah, but is Jesus, is he the crashed reflector, cardboard reflector thing?
And the scotch tape, yeah.
Or is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Standard. It's like you said, it's kind of an Occam's razor. Like, if you're a historian, you're just going to look at all available evidence, real evidence, you know, documents and whatever. And then you're going to say, okay, what kind of a picture is this going to? It's sort of like courtroom, right? It's like, it's a bit forensic, but it doesn't have the same standard of like disproving the null. Like, you don't have to do that at all. Yeah. And so because of that, it does seem reasonable that Jesus existed, but I don't think, like you said, you can't say it anywhere close to beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah. So I agree. That's a good analogy. I think that's right. I think that, so I think I can accept the conclusion that that is the best current inference we have from all available evidence. And it is the most parsimonious inference that there was a guy named Jesus. But that's different than saying he probably really existed. I think that they conflate those two things. I would say simultaneously, we could also conclude we just don't know. And there's lots of other possibilities that are perfectly compatible with the evidence that we have. And when you really understand like how myths are fabricated out of whole cloth or based upon the flimsiest of actual events, you know, then it makes it much more plausible that, yeah, could that have been manufactured out of whole cloth with all this complexity and stuff we can't explain and inconvenience? Yeah, sure. I have no problem believing that either. But I think that's because I have more of a skeptic's perspective and I think historians, especially ancient historians, are used to just making the best inference and saying that's the best answer we have.
Sure.
All right. So my takeaway from all of this is that Steve hates Jesus.
Okay. But Jesus loves Steve. So it evens out.
No, I have to say I'm fascinated by Christian mythology. I actually like it.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. It is fascinating. I mean, I grew up, you know, I'm probably not as well read as Steve is. But it has been a hobby of mine. I mean, I do pick up the Bible and read it from time to time.
Do you?
Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting. And there's a lot of wonderful things in that book.
It's a hard book to just like casually read.
But to think, not casually, I mean, you know, there are stories. I mean, I know all the stories, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm a fan
more than me.
I'm a fan of the written word and of poetry. Mm. So that it does interest me in that aspect as well. But to think, and the thing that is such an incredible, you know, mind bender here, from my perspective, I don't believe that Jesus existed, and I don't believe in any of the mythology. And to think that when I walk around and I'm surrounded by people that not only believe in Christ, but there are people that believe in lots of other religions and gods and demigods, that's in their minds, you know, like that, those thoughts are a living thing in their minds. And I so wholeheartedly reject it. And that's
as much a part of their reality as anything else we talk about on the show.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right, Evan, we're going to go from Jesus to the Hobbit. Tell us
what you're talking about. Great.
Well, not the Hobbit in the sense of the movies or Tolkien or anything. More correctly, we're going to talk about Homo floresiensis, commonly referred to as Florus Man. We're talking about the remains of an individual discovered in 2003 at Liang Bua on the island of Flores in Indonesia. Now, Florus Man, the remains, they estimate that It would have stood about 3.5 feet tall. That's just over a meter. And the remains consist of partial skeletons of, so far they've got 9 individuals, but one complete skull, which is very cool. And these remains...
I thought it was Flores' woman. Is it really Flores' man?
Well, it's...
Why did I always think the Hobbit was a... It is, I mean, female. Obviously it's multiple.
It's a little weird to call it Flores, but just Floresiensis. Just Homo Floresiensis.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
It is weird because it's like the one specimen's a woman, so it's...
Okay. So I'm not losing my mind. Good.
Very good. But the remains have been the subject of intense research to determine whether they represent a species distinct from modern humans. Yes, this is a story we've been covering for some time on the SG. Many years we've been covering it. We've been very curious about it. I think there are two main reasons why. First of all, biological anthropology is cool. Anything having to do with evolution is cool. It is one of the bedrocks of modern science. And there's this fundamental scientific aspect to the story that these remains... in its own right, maybe their own thing, essentially, totally different. And the second reason I think that's equally cool, it's a really good example of how science works and this debate going on in the scientific community, which is unfolding right before us in the internet age, gives us a great example of watching scientists in action trying to figure out exactly where it fits into the evolutionary bush. So is it a new species of hominin, likely evolved from Homo erectus, displaying an example of island dwarfism? Or is it the remains of not a new species at all and represents a pathological Homo sapien of some sort? Or is it something else entirely? Well, the news is that the most comprehensive study on the bones of Homo floresiensis has been done, and they found that it most likely evolved from an ancestor from Africa, and not from Homo erectus, as had been widely believed by one of the main camps. At the same time, the study seems to have, I think, severely diminished the chance that Flores man was Homo sapien at all.
Mm-hmm.
The researchers
said that they're almost 100% sure that it's not Homo sapiens.
Almost 100% sure. They pretty much knocked that part of the equation out, which is a big, big step. The study was conducted by the Australian National University, ANU, and they found that it was most likely a sister species of Homo habilis, which dates back to 1.75 million years ago. And that puts Homo habilis found only on the continent of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So, wow, we're talking about something else, a sort of a new layer here. How did this sister species of Homo habilis wind up on an island in the Pacific?
Oh, yeah, that is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So they think, I see, so they think that it's an offshoot of, why did I always think it was Homo habilis?
It could be.
Again.
Depends whether you're British habilis? Or American.
Or America. And British, also for me, it depends habilis. On if you're Texan, I think. So they think that Homo habilis evolved, and then probably some of them somehow found their ways to this island and then exhibited island dwarfism from that particular species.
And
so here, let me summarize this for you. So the previously the debate was this a pathological human or
yes, Homo sapiens,
or was it an offshoot of Homo erectus? Because Homo erectus was the only species or the earliest species that we knew of that migrated out of Africa. Mm-hmm. And but Homo erectus, as the name implies, they're big, they're tall, they're erect, right?
Yeah.
And so this species would have definitely represented island dwarfism if it developed from Homo erectus.
Right.
But now they're saying, they said that the specimen, when they did their more detailed analysis, not only did it not match Homo sapiens, it also did not match Homo erectus. It matched better with Homo habilis, and it shared primitive features in common with Homo habilis. So probably the Homo habilis is its closest common ancestor, or it shares a close
common ancestor.
It shares a close common ancestor with Homo habilis. But that means that there was a separate migration out of Africa that wasn't Homo erectus, that may have predated Homo erectus. But because habilis are so small, it wouldn't have had to have too much in the way of island dwarfism.
I'd love to see its brain structure on such a small head.
I think they have casts, don't they?
Seismic orange, I think I read
endocasts?
Somewhere.
I mean, I mean,
I think you've done
get
it.
Some
yeah.
basic, you can get some basic ideas of organization, but not a real, like, you know, autopsy on a brain just to see how the
they tried to do that. They tried to do that with like CT scan studies.
Yeah, they do CTs. And then they sort of
they did argue retro. That they their brains may there is a suggestion that their brains may have been more compact and that therefore they are more intelligent than may be apparent just from the size of their brain. So it's interesting.
They're all bipedal,
they're
right?
Like, yeah, they're bipedal.
Yeah, habilis and yeah. It's funny. I'm looking at habilis online right now, just like an image of the bust and the reconstructions, of course, that they do. And in like so human, but also so ape-like. It's like it's halfway in between. But it makes me. It just brings back home when you go to a zoo or when you have an opportunity to stand face to face with a chimpanzee or with an orangutan or even a bonobo. Just how human they are.
Yeah, it really is freaky.
It's amazing.
So
yeah, it's freaky.
There's still over the years. There's basically been two camps. One camp saying that Floresiensis is really a human, a modern human, and the other one saying that they're their own species. So what I'm still waiting to see is how the other camp is going to respond to this study, because I don't really consider the controversy to be over until the other side gives in and says, okay, you're right. The evidence now is clear. So we'll see. I'm still waiting to see the response of the scientific community. There may still be holdouts. So the other thing that could end debate would be DNA. Like with the Denisovans, right? But the thing is, the Denisovans are from the frozen tundra, right? This is now a tropical species, so the DNA
doesn't
survive
quite as well.
Yeah, it's going to
last that long.
So, we may not find DNA, unfortunately.
What's the DNA cutoff, the degradation, like the half-life?
Yeah, it's about that. It's like 100,000 years, 60,000 years. But it depends on the environment. This is probably an unfavorable environment for DNA.
Yeah, you need something that's really, really nice and, you know, buried in the mud or something, you know, and preserved as best as possible.
That's insane. Like the fact that this was living at the same time as Homo sapiens, just stuck on this island and no one knew.
They could have still been there, you know, theoretically. Imagine if there's like a little patch of Homo habilis running around somewhere. That would be amazing.
Oh my God.
Oh man.
I think I would die of awesomeness.
Yeah.
But think of the ethics that would bring
come
up.
On.
All right, guys, let's move on. Jay, who's that noisy time?
Last week I played this noisy. What do you think it is?
I don't know, but if I was a movie producer, that would be the noise my alien made.
Yeah.
Right? It's so good.
Yeah, it is cool. I have somebody that had a worst guess that I'll read to you first. This is from John Setterfield. And John said, the first thing that comes to mind was the sound the Triffids made in the 1963 version of The Day of the Triffids. I tried to find a sound of the Triffids, and it was very hard without a lot of music behind it, and I couldn't, actually, but... kind of, maybe a little, but not really, John. So, sorry.
I could see it.
The winning guess, sent in by Noel Rupenthal, said, "Hi, Jay. This week's sound is the vibration in the magnetic field of Comet 67P, as recorded by the Rosetta mission.
Cool.
Ooh.
So, Marcel Janssens, who sent the noisy in, wrote, "The Rosetta spacecraft and its Philae lander have a lot to teach scientists about what Comet 67P looks like, it is composed of, and even what it smells like. But what does the comet sound like? The day before Philae made history by landing on the surface of the comet, ESA released an audio clip of it singing. The weird thing about this was they had to speed this up quite a bit because the frequency was so low and so slow that we couldn't hear it. So they sped it up to get into human, you know, range for our ears to hear, and that's what it sounded like. So it was making that noise just very, very slowly. Very cool. I love that type of stuff. You know, they're finding an anomaly, they're recording it, you know, they're making it something that humans can understand and be digestible, and that, my friends, is science.
Mm-hmm.
Science!
That is cool. I like that.
This week's noisy reminds me of so many things, and this one will be very fun to talk about. I think I predict a couple of people will get this, and I think most of you will say, sounds familiar, but I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like the music from the movie Buck Rogers.
I know exactly what scene you're talking about, Bob.
Wait,
when Twicky starts dancing, yeah.
Yeah,
my gosh. Scary.
Interesting hint. I will say that, Bob. Interesting hint. So if you think you know what that is, and be specific, don't say it's a song. Tell me how it was created. You know, give me the details. This one I'm going to be very particular on. If you think you know what that is, or if you heard anything cool this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. Yeah.
Before we go on.
Yes.
You and I have something very important to talk about.
That's correct.
The Nexus conference happening this summer. Guys, this is going to be a good one. We have James Randi coming to the conference.
Yes.
Woohoo!
Right, so if you don't know who James Randi is, he is a legendary paranormal investigator, a magician, an escape artist, and he's a friend of the SGU. We've known Randi for a long time at this point. God, didn't we have Randi? The first time I think I met Randi, Steve, was at MIT when we brought him in to give a talk. Remember that?
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
And Yale he came to Yale and gave a lecture. This was in the 90s. Jeez. Yeah.
And at one point, I remember at one point, Randi came over to Steve's house and had a meal with us. And we didn't, right? Remember that, Steve?
Yeah.
And we didn't know him well at that time either.
I know. And when he left, you realized all the forks were bent.
So, yeah, it turns out that, you know, we did become friends with Randi. He is a wonderful human being. He's funny. He's intelligent. He is incredibly creative. And he is going to be putting a show on the Friday night of the Nexus conference, and I don't think you should miss this. This is a wonderful show that Randi puts on. It's just him. Let me just tell you a couple of things about Randi. He exposed a faith healer named Peter Popoff on The Tonight Show after essentially hacking this guy's secret wireless broadcast that his wife was sending him to give him all the answers about the faith healing BS. He also planted two fake psychics at a university. They studied parapsychology, and he fooled physicists into believing, or he trained these two students to fool the physicists into believing that they had psychic powers. And these were not trained magicians. They were pulling tricks off that Randi showed them like hours before, that type of thing. It was unbelievable. What a great story. He also broke Harry Houdini's record for the length of time he was sealed in the underwater casket. I think his was at 1 hour, 44 minutes. And there's a wonderful documentary about his life called An Honest Liar that won an audience award and best feature at 2014 AFI Docs Festival. So
yeah, that was really good.
Yeah, it was. It was good. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot.
His show is on Friday, June 30th at 8 p.m. And it's called An Evening with James Randi. And we really invite you to please come and come to the conference and come see Randy's show. You can go to nexus.org, NECSS.org, for all the details, the dates, the registration. We still have early bird registration.
But you got to hurry.
Got to hurry. Price is going to go up after that.
And hey, we're all going to be there.
Yeah, of course. SGU will be there. We're going to be doing our live show. We're going to be doing a private show. Steve and I are going to be doing several workshops, which will be on the Thursday before the conference. A lot of stuff going on. Don't miss it.
All right. Thanks, Jay.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. We have a theme this week, which was inspired by my news item, and the theme is weird shit about the ancient world, which we've done before, but I'm doing it again, because there's like endless weird stuff about the ancient world. Okay. Item number one, Socrates left behind no writings. We know of him only from the accounts of others. Item number two, the ancient Greeks greatly revered large penis size, which they believed was the source of strength and courage. And item number three, there were proctologists in ancient Egypt who were called the Nehru Foot, which literally translates to shepherd of the anus.
That's awesome.
Oh my god.
All right, Jay, go first. When I grow up, I want to be a shepherd of the anus.
I am Nehru Foot.
Oh, I pronounced that. It's anus.
Socrates left behind no writing. We know him only from the accounts of others. Wow, I think that one is so science. Probably thinking of somebody else. So I got to put that in the back burner. Let's jump to the second one here. The ancient Greeks, they greatly revered large penis size, which they believed was a source of strength and courage. Now, how is that different from today?
Is that a rhetorical question?
Yeah, I could see that being science too. I mean, you just figure culturally, penis size is probably important in lots of cultures. And of course, you're going to assign strength and courage to it. Okay, so let's get to this last one here. There were proctologists in ancient Egypt who were called Nehru Foot, which literally translates to shepherd of the anus. Now, how? See, I can't help but think, what's wrong with this? What did Steve author make up, flip around? That is so funny. God, shepherd of the anus. That is awesome. If I were a proctologist today, I would wear a badge that says that in the ancient Egyptian. And anybody that knew what it said, I'd let them have a free visit that day.
A free rectal exam?
Wow, this is really hard, Steve. This is like, I have nothing. I got nothing. All right, I'm gonna chip these away. So yes, I do think that Socrates, I don't think he wrote anything. And why wouldn't the ancient Greeks revere large penis size? I don't know. All right, I have to believe in my inner love for craziness. Shepherd of the anus has to be science. So I'm going to say that the ancient Greeks did not revere large penis the way Steve reveres large penis.
Okay, Kara.
I think I'm going to go with Jay on this one. I mean, I'm pretty sure that most of Socrates, what we think of as Socrates' writings, were written down by like Plato or by some of his disciples. I think that was pretty common because he was like a great thinker. I have no idea if Shepherd of the Anus is an ancient proctologist, but I want that to be true. But when I think of Greek statues, like when I think of these beautiful marble statues, none of them had big penises. They were usually actually really small. And so I want to assume that there's some sort of a relationship there, like that maybe small penises were revered, or maybe they just didn't think about it. But I've never seen an ancient Greek statue with a giant dong. And if they really revered it, I think that there would be at least one of them.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, Socrates, blah, blah, whatever. The proctologist, yeah, whatever for that too. I mean, sure, that's just too cool not to go with it. And hopefully Steve will be going for that, hoping that we believe that. The Greeks, yeah, it's the Italians that obviously revered large penis size. To this day, I have a memory from the early 80s being at Pompeii, and this guy kept calling over my mom to show her some of the statues that were there, the little statues, and I could hear him. He'd be, hey, lady, and he'd show my mom a picture of a guy with a huge penis, like, dude, what's the deal? So yeah, it was the Italians and not the Greeks that revered them, so I'm going to say that it's fiction.
And Evan.
Sure, I'll go with them. I say that it's the penis size one that's going to be the fiction. I think it's quite the opposite. I think it was the small penis size, I think, that they revered. Because on all the statues, they all have small members. And I think it had to do with modesty or moderation or something like that. There was had nothing to do with strength and courage.
So I'm going to go with agility. Contributes to agility.
Okay, so you're all going with the big penis.
Of course we are.
All right.
That's one way of putting it.
I have no choice.
With arms open wide, yes.
Okay, so I guess I'll take these in order. Socrates left behind no writings. We know of him only from the accounts of others. You all think this one is science, and that one is science. That is true.
Yeah, do it.
Right. That's messed up.
Wrote nothing. Socrates, I know. We know about him because of his disciples, the most famous of which is Plato.
Bill and Ted.
There was something about Socrates' philosophy that made him eschew writing. So it wasn't just that he just didn't have time. It was like beneath him or something. So
it was beneath him, yet not beneath Plato.
right.
To pick wow. up.
I know
a pen,
that's not the real reason. I don't know. I don't understand the real reason. But I don't want to get into the weeds with the philosophy, or whatever. But just say that it was a philosophical reason why he didn't do any writing. But yeah,
I'll start writing right after I taste this hemlock.
We only know about him from the works of others. Yeah, very interesting. Socrates is one of the. So it's interesting because some people, you know, getting back to the Jesus thing, they say, oh, there's so many parallels with other stories, which is true. But again, it's like you could focus your attention on what you want. So if you could summarize the story of the life of Socrates in such a way to make it seem like an exact parallel with Jesus, right?
Yeah.
You know, he was a philosopher, but, you know, didn't write anything down. He was known only from his disciples. He was arrested and executed by the authorities for being whatever. You know, there's a lot of those parallels. Obviously, there's a lot that are not, you know, not parallels.
And his disciples, at least, wrote all this shit down while he was still alive.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the difference.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
Yeah, big difference.
Like, as he was saying stuff, they would write it down.
Right, yeah, a little bit different. So, but the second one is the one you guys all think is fiction. The ancient Greeks greatly revered large penis size, which they believed was a source of strength and courage. But before I do the reveal, I want to point out a couple of things.
That reveal.
So, Bob, you just said a very false memory about our mother.
Andrew, awesome. Hit me with it, baby.
So I'll tell you how I remember that. When we were in Herculaneum in Pompeii, Mom was telling us that story about the last time she was there, but not when she was there with us. So you remember Mom recounting that story, but we did not witness it.
Oh, you conflated.
Wow, that's awesome.
I also think that a lot of Italian statues also have tiny penises. Like, doesn't David have a tiny penis? That's Italian, right?
Yeah, so that's the other point, Bob, is that
he's 16 feet
so
tall.
The Roman culture was based largely on Greek culture, and it is true that Greek statues typically had small penises, but so did Roman statues. But Kara, there are Greek statues with large penises, specifically Priapus. You know who Priapus was?
Well, I know what a priapism is. So.
That's where the word priapism comes from.
That's awesome.
Of course. Holy crap.
Priapus was cursed to have a perpetual boner and be impotent at the same time.
Oh, that's my so God. Sad.
All right. So
what
this
did he do?
One,
his case of Viagra.
This one
so
is.
Steve, wait. Before we even go there, I like how you just assume my memory is false and yours correct. Just saying.
Yeah. I'm just telling you.
Where's the written record?
That's why I said my memory is.
Yeah, but you also called mine a false memory.
Steve, I remember it the way Bob does, so you're outnumbered.
Ha!
Oh, let's ask Mom.
Let's not.
No, it's funny, but that's how memory works. Like you conflated her telling that story with something that we experienced directly, but we did not.
Totally.
We were making fun of that. We were making fun of that while we were going through Herculaneum because Mom had already told us that story. Anyway,
but it wasn't Herculaneum. It was Pompeii.
Or whatever. We went through both, so it was one of those two. I don't remember which one.
Well, I got
Pompeii. If you do one, you do the other.
Hey, lady.
Mom kept mimicking that while we were there, but we didn't see that happen. Anyway.
That's hilarious. That's awesome.
All right. So this one is... The fiction. You guys are all
the
correct.
Fiction.
Oh, yeah,
so,
yeah.
Because in Greek culture, they actually preferred small penises. And that's why all the statues have the small penises. Because they associated a large penis with being a fool, with being a brute, a barbarian. They also, you know, when statues did have a large penis, it was grotesque. You know, it was on like a satyr or
devilish
animal, chimera or something
considered monstrous.
Yeah, exactly. Or like Priapus, you know, it was considered to be a positive feature.
It's funny because we kind of have our own version of that, even though, you know, modern, I think, culture does associate a big penis with, like, I don't know, being virile or whatever. We do kind of associate being overly, I don't know, what would the word be? Obsessed with image?
Oh.
Or like, you know, a woman with really large breasts or even a guy with like really big muscles as being stupid. Like, we definitely make those associations.
Oh, sure. Oh, my God, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, that's kind of like the male bimbo brains. Thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny.
Oh, yeah. you're so smart, Bob.
But yeah, but Kara was the first one to hit upon... Kara was the first one to hit upon the statues. That was the line of evidence. That was correct.
Kara, you were hitting on statues?
Yeah, baby. Those small penises.
When I was reading about this, I was reading about David because David, you know, has a small penis too. First of all, it's like the question was, why do all the ancient statues have small penises? And the answer was, well, first of all, those are normal size. Thank you.
Yeah.
Those are not, they're not really anatomically small. They're just normal. And the second answer was,
here. And they're not erect either.
They're not erect. Like, they're just not erect. But for David, some people believe that Michelangelo made him deliberately made it look as if David was physically reacting with fear. And so there's lots of subtle aspects to his posture and the tension in his muscles that that betray fear, because he's looking at the giant at that moment, you know, in the statue. And so they think that maybe like his scrotum was being pulled in because of the fear, and that was deliberate. Wow. But it was also consistent with the artistic tradition. All of this means that there were proctologists in ancient Egypt who were called Nerufut, which literally translates to shepherd of the anus, is science. And I had to include that. Shepherd of the anus. I mean, come on. I had to
include that. That's awesome.
That is awesome. That is funny. Good job, guys. You got the penis. I mean, you got the right answer. Good job. It is fun. I love these little windows into such alien cultures that it's like hard for us to even wrap our minds around, you know. At the same time, like you think about like ancient Greek or Rome, from one perspective they're us. They're exactly the same, you know. But from another perspective, it's a completely alien culture in a way that their view of the universe is so different than ours.
Yeah, and you know, hundreds of years from now, I mean, think about what humans might be thinking is the appropriate reality, appropriate way to think about things.
So guys, before we do the quote, our next live streaming event is going to be May 13th at 1 p.m. Eastern time. We're going to be streaming live to our Facebook page. This is not going to be a show. It's going to be its own content. We're going to be reviewing a movie, which we haven't decided which one it's going to be yet, and probably discussing some other topics. So you'll get to see our updated lair, Skeptolair, and we've done a bit of a lighting and tech update, so hopefully it'll look nice. And you're going to get some extra content and get to see all of our faces while we do it. Should be a lot of fun. So
yay.
Join
it
us.
It'll be fun.
So May 13th, 1 p.m. Eastern time. And Evan, give us a quote.
Yeah, submitted to us by listener Jim Fitzsimmons from St. Paul, Minnesota. Thanks, Jim. I really like this one. The power to tell real from fake doesn't come from being a world expert or mistrusting every single thing you see. It comes from an honest willingness to change your opinions and beliefs based on new facts. So learn to enjoy being wrong. The world might start making more sense. You won't feel quite as out of step with the rest of humanity. Your words won't cause needless pain to people who suffered real tragedies. And the words of others won't sway you into believing myths over truth. And that's from our friend Captain Disillusion.
Yay!
From one of his videos titled The Undebunkable.
The Undebunkable. All of his videos are great. You should take a look at them. Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely. He's a staple on YouTube. Go ahead, look him up. Captain Disillusion, our friend Alan. He does a great job with those productions.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Yep.
Thanks, sure, Steve. Man.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.